Since I was last here on Friday, a week ago, we finished off teaching a retreat, and then also went off to Singapore on Tuesday to give a series of talks, and finished off last night, a very late night for a monk, because the group in Singapore, the Buddhist Fellowship, had their annual gala dinner. So even though I didn't have anything to eat, which was torture, seeing all that beautiful food and the plate to my left and the plate to the right, I had to give a little talk. And they asked me, can you please give a talk to about 1,000 members who are there for this annual event? A little talk on putting meaning into your life, giving your life meaning. And I thought that's a wonderful little topic, and I wanted to do the same again today, to give a talk on putting meaning into your life. And it was especially apt because Ajahn Bhamani showed me a copy of today's Western Australian, and it was one of my favourite. I always try and read the comics first of all. That's the most interesting part of a newspaper. And one of my favourite comic strips is Calvin and Hobbes. And if you saw that one today, and you know that's a comic strip, there's always a great deal of not just humour but philosophy in that. In this particular comic strip, that Calvin is in bed with his tiger next to him and saying just about what is the meaning of life, why are we put on this earth, now what are we here for? And his little pet tiger says, tiger food. Which from a tiger's point of view, that's what human beings are there for. But I'm sure there's much more meaning to life than being tiger food, or right now in Western Australia, just as opportunities for flies in the forest to go and explore, because now is a fly season, at least it was when I left. And of course, those of you who live out in the bush, in the forests, at this time of year, these flies, they just like coming and being kind to you. At least that's what happens in Serpentine, probably the same in Dharamsala, because the flies in the monastery are all Buddhist flies, and so they're more compassionate than other flies, so they come up and come up close and personal, as they say. But when it comes to giving your life meaning, I mentioned last night just some of the stories of my life and just how I wanted to give my life meaning. Many of you know the sort of some of my biography, you know, coming from a poor family, but through scholarships, you know, going to a very good school in West London, and from that good school going to Cambridge. And it was at that time, I remember, just you know, being at a great university and having all these opportunities open for me in life and wondering which opportunity, which path should I take. And of course, the meaning of life and giving your life meaning was an important consideration. In fact, it was the main consideration which drove me along this path of being a monk. Because when I was at the age of about 19 or 20, when you're looking at what career, what path are you going to follow in life, I sort of thought very deeply, and I decided that whatever path, whatever career which I was going to follow in life had to fulfill two purposes. I just tried to boil it down just to something simple which I could understand and which could guide my life in the future. And those two purposes were, it had to be a life, a career, had to be something which gave me personal fulfillment. You can't deny just personal happiness is important to you. So I had to find something which would actually give me some inner happiness in my life. But the second part was also very, very important. I also had to find a career which could be of service to others, which could affect other people and make their lives less painful, less confusing, and less difficult. Somehow in my life I had to balance what I thought was my own search for happiness with my desire to actually to serve other people and to see just how a career, a path in life could fulfill those two meanings of life, service to others and the pursuit of one's own happiness. And of course, you know that I found that wonderful combination of doing both at the same time in the path of a monk. Nowhere. Not only do you get enormous inner happiness for yourself, and especially just when you go and do some meditation, you get incredible peace and immense bliss. And those of you who've been on retreat with me, you know why monks are celibate. It's not because we're weird. The reason why monks are celibate is because basically we've got a happiness which is better than sex. You know, the deep happiness is of meditation. And look, so those people who have experienced those states will just say exactly what I say. It's much better, you know, than sex. And also you don't have the complications of babies and, you know, diseases and stuff like that. So that's why I really like the happiness of deep meditation. But it's not just that happiness which one goes for. You know, I'm not a hermit. Sometimes I love to be a hermit. Now, sometimes, you know, I think for those of you who are following the sort of the bhikkhuni thing, it'd be wonderful if I get excommunicated from everything. And then I can really be a hermit. Actually, that's my really real plan. No, I'm only joking. But, you know, I like being alone. I like meditating alone. So you've got a sort of a resource of happiness there. But there's something else which really motivates me, which gives my life meaning. And that is actually being able to effectively be of service and being of help to other people. And of course, that you know, because of so many people come here and so many people listen to the talks on their iPods, and you know, I just do get invited to go to places like Singapore, where on Tuesday night and Wednesday night there's probably about 3,000 people on every night listening to the talks. So there's a huge number of people listen to these talks. Now, can you imagine what it's like for being, you know, me, and being able to talk and really help in a big way people's lives. To be able to serve in such a way that problems which other people can't fix do get fixed. For those of you who've purchased a copy of Opening the Door of Your Heart, you know, the new version, you know, with a picture of a bird on the front rather than a Bodhi leaf, you may have noticed that the preface to that edition was relating to a story which happened about a year ago over in Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine. Just now on the morning lunch period, you know, people coming up to offer the lunch. And that day there was a new person had come. I've never seen her before. She was maybe an elderly lady, maybe 50 or 60. I shouldn't have said elderly. I really made a big blue there. I've got to be more careful to my audience. But anyway, she's about 50, 60 years of age, and I'd never seen her before. And then I asked her who she was, and she said she was from Switzerland. She was from the city of Bern. And then she said, if I wouldn't mind signing her book for her. You know, the Opening the Door of Your Heart book. And I said, certainly I can sign that. And when she handed me the copy of her book, it was dog-eared. It had obviously been really well used, and I was very pleased with that. And I said, I'm very happy to sign your book. But then she said, the reason I wanted you to sign this book and the reason I came here was because back in Switzerland I had a terminal cancer, I had anxiety attacks, depression, I was a mess, both medically and psychologically. And my doctors, my psychologists and psychiatrists, they were putting me on all types of pills and medication, but nothing was working. I was getting worse and worse. I was a medical mess. And one of my psychologists gave me a copy of your book. And 3 months later, I don't need any more medication. My psychologist said, you don't need it anymore. Cancer is gone. I've got my life back. And she said she'd flown all the way from Switzerland to Perth, Western Australia, not to see the bell tower, but to but to see Ajahn Brahm, just to come and say thank you. And that's an accurate, true story. So can you imagine what I felt like when I was signing it and she was crying, tears streaming down her cheeks out of gratitude. Thank you for doing something. And I think the reason why I mention that story is because it shows you what the meaning of life is and how we can put that meaning into our lives. is a sense of worth, of value. That's what meaning actually is. The worth and value which we put into our lives. And that worth and value is something which you don't get when you get your paycheck at the end of the month or when you get it transferred into your account. That worth and that value is not measured in your material gains. It's measured in something which you might call one's spiritual wealth. And that meaning, you always see where it comes from. In your ability to serve, to be kind, to be generous, to help in the biggest way possible. And it's important that we recognize this, because otherwise when people don't have any meaning, they don't put that meaning in their life, this is why people get depressed, why they have lack of self-esteem, why they get lonely, and why they have this inner pain of, what am I supposed to be doing in this world? It's not just being tiger food. It's much more than that. And you can understand what it is when, number one, you understand what that meaning is, and number two, you actually put that meaning into your life. And again, so I always love giving stories, and the stories have to be from my life, because I'm the only life which I know. I don't know your lives. But my life, again, going back to the time when I was a student at college, you know, that I was the only Buddhist I knew for many years before I went to college. And even when I went to university, and there was only a couple of Buddhists, and there was no one else in, you know, in my college I knew who was a Buddhist. So you hang around with your friends, you go to parties, you know, go chasing girls, all that sort of stuff, which you do as a young man. But one of my friends, he was a Christian. He was a very devout Christian. We used to have wonderful arguments together, but not arguments trying to put another person down or to be superior to them, but these nice philosophical arguments. We just wanted to find out the truth. And our friendship was strong enough that you could argue and argue with a person, and you'd realize the friendship was more than strong enough to withstand any argument, and we'd end up as friendly as we was when we started. That's a wonderful thing with friendship, because it gives us that trust. And with that trust, it gives us the space to actually to say what we're thinking, because we know we're not going to offend the other person. And it's so important to have that trust with another person. We can just open up our minds, open up our hearts, and then open up our mouths, knowing that the other person understands what we're saying. And it's nothing personal, we just want to find out the truth, and we can challenge one another. And you know that recently, that when we have been having all these dialogues, especially with the Benedictine monks in Eunorcia, it's wonderful that we've got that trust there with these monks, that we can have arguments, and we can actually have a nice cup of tea and a bit of chocolate afterwards, and we're still the best of friends. And I think that's a great thing about human beings. When we value the friendship more than anything else, we can ask the tough questions. When we ask the tough questions, we realize we're not offending the other person, because our friendship is stronger. And of course, hopefully you feel that with the monks and the nuns here, that our friendship towards you is so strong that you can ask the most offensive questions and I will not get upset at you. So try that at the end of this talk. So, you know, one of the most difficult questions which I was ever asked, I remember many years ago, 20 years ago, I went to one of these schools. And that's always, you've got to be really on your toes when you go to give a talk at a West Australian high school, especially if it's a government school, because if it's a public school, the private schools, they can kick the kids out. But the public schools, they just have to sort of allow people to be there. So, you know, when it came, I gave a nice talk about Buddhism, you know, about sort of kindness and compassion. But that just, you know, didn't do anything, because when it came to question time, any question kids, this one girl, maybe about 14 or 15, she put up her hands and said, "No, Ajahn Brahm, you're a monk. Do girls turn you on still?" You know what kids are like. They really try to sort of, you know, wide you up. And you know what I said? I didn't need to, because one of the other girls there said, "Oh, don't listen to her. She's always embarrassing us." But the nice thing is you can laugh and you don't get offended when people ask you tough questions. And so because of that, we have this beautiful openness of, you know, questioning and debate, not to get offended. And I think it's very important that we can have that questioning to find out what the meaning is of life. And I think you do question, you do ask, and you do find that those meanings of life, you know, are just the spiritual qualities of kindness and giving. In this particular case, my friend, you know, the Christian, when I was arguing one day, he said, you know, Buddhism is selfish. He said, as a Christian, so, you know, we help people. You know, we go out to sort of hospitals and poor people and elderly people's homes to try and help and serve. And he just happened to mention that he was going to this hospital for those people who are mentally disabled, who are institutionalized, and him with a couple of his fellow Christians were going once a week to help out, do OT work, occupational therapy work, for some kids with Down syndrome. And when I heard that he was doing that, and that was what Christians were doing, I thought, I'm going to stand up for Buddhism. He said, if you can do it, I can do it as well. So I volunteered as well. And I must say, there was no noble intentions in me volunteering. It was strictly keeping up with the Joneses. It was just ego, absolutely. And I admit that. So I went along with the Christians and we helped out with these Down syndrome kids. And this is no exaggeration. You know, my friends, they dropped out after 3 or 4 weeks. Well, I kept on going for 2 years. I kept on going every week. I was up in college, I think on a Wednesday afternoon, just going out to this hospital, Fulbourne Hospital, if anyone knows Cambridge, and just going into these groups of kids institutionalized with Down syndrome and just doing stuff with them. And that was part of my week which I valued. And I wouldn't give that up for anything. And in fact, towards the end of the 2 years, when, you know, I was talking to everybody, they knew what I was up to. I was just about to do my final examinations and just leave the college and go into life, wherever that would lead me. I remember one session, one afternoon, because I was very skilled and they had administration to do, they gave me the whole sort of, you know, 15 or 16 kids to look after. And then we had tea. And then they gave me the other 15 or 16 kids to look after. And I was doing it by myself. And afterwards, they brought all the kids together. Because what had happened was, the 15 or 16 kids I was looking after, the other ones, the OT people were getting to make cards for me. Because this was going to be my last day. And when I was looking after them, they kept quiet. Then the other kids were making the cards. And afterwards, they gave me the presentation of all these cards from these Down syndrome children. Because they said I was by far the longest volunteer they'd ever had. And they gave me all these cards and made me cry. You know how I learned how to cry? From those Down syndrome children. They taught me what I call these days emotional language. If ever you're talking with me and I can connect with you, it's not because I learned what I learned in the lecture halls of Cambridge. It's because of what I learned in that hospital. These were people who could not talk in an intellectual way. Their ability to string words together in meaningful sentences wasn't that hot. But my goodness, they could look at me and know if I was in a bad mood or know if I was in a happy mood. They can pick me up straight away. And they taught me that language. A language which doesn't think about a person, but feels them. And is so sensitive to their emotional connection with another person that they were geniuses in emotional language. And that's what I learned from them. And that's why I was just so touched at their emotional thank you in these little cards that I cried. And then after the presentation, I remember just asking them, with tears in my eyes, begging them, saying, my exams are not for another 10 days. Can I please come next week? So I did an extra week, more than I was asked. And I often look back, why did I enjoy that? And of course, it gave me meaning. Much more meaning than learning about the secrets of the universe in theoretical physics. That was interesting, but it really didn't give meaning in my life. That's where I've started to understand the selfless giving, the service, the kindness which you give out into this world, that is the currency of meaning. And to this day, when people come up and say they have a problem, especially kids, that they have a drug problem, or they have a relationship problem, or especially they're depressed or they're angry, one of the great solutions which I have tried, works, and share with other people, if you are feeling depressed, lost, not knowing what to do in this world, for goodness sake, go and do some service. Find a group. Find an old people's home. Find a place like where my mother is with dementia. Find a place where you can serve. And just go out, spend the time, and give. And you'll find that however much you give, as everybody who's done service knows, you get 10,000 times more back in return. And you find your meaning is not in what you accumulate, but how much you can let go and give to others. That becomes the meaning of your life and how it grows and grows and grows. And so by doing that little bit of service, the reason I love going there was because I was learning so much and getting so much happiness just being with kids who would never argue with me about philosophy or religion. They would just give me a hug when they knew I needed one. And that was a hard thing for a straight boy to be hugged by another boy. To be able to do that and be able to receive just their warmth was something which I hope you'll understand has added to my ability to be a monk and a teacher today. So thank you to all those kids in Fulbourne Hospital for teaching me how to be a monk. So when you find out that that's the type of meaning you in life, it means you take the opportunities to serve, to give, to help, or whatever. And you'll find that that is much powerful to give you the energy and the happiness of life which we all need. You can't just give to your family. They're a bit too close. It has to be something more than that. And I'm just saying, just giving to a place like people with Alzheimer's, with dementia. When I was visiting my mother just about 6 weeks ago, when I went to London, I think I mentioned to you that I went there just in the last hope that my mother would still remember me. I got from my brother that she was losing her memory fast. So I went just to see if she could still remember her son. And she couldn't. She didn't know who I was. She'd gone past that boundary where her memory of even her closest relations is totally gone. But I spent 2 lovely hours with her. My brother afterwards told me this story about a man who would visit his mother every day before he went to work. Every day he'd go and visit his mother who had Alzheimer's. And one day the doctor came up to him and said, "Look, what are you doing this for? You're wasting your time. She doesn't even know you. She can't remember you. If you only came once a week or 2 weeks, she wouldn't know that you hadn't come for such a long time. So what are you doing this? She doesn't know you." And he replied, "It's true, she doesn't know I'm her son. But I know she's my mother. That's why I go every day." And I thought, wow, that's a guy who has emotional intelligence, who knows the meaning of life. It's not because she knows who you are. It's because you know who she is. And that gives you incredible strength. It is not really rational. That's where the doctor was coming from. Rational, scientific. But there is another language, which is the language of meaning of life. It's the same when you're kind and when you're generous. every act of generosity and kindness which I have given in my life, never one of those acts of kindness and generosity have I ever regretted. Even though sometimes people thought, you're stupid, Ajahn Brahm, doing things like that. And I still remember just one of the first acts of generosity which I gave. You may not know this, but when I was a young man, I've already told you about my green velvet trousers. I also had very long hair and a big beard as well. It was very useful in the cold climate of London. I never had to wear a hat. I had a permanent one on. And where the frizzy hair ended, that's when my beard started. I used to call it like the donut look, because I had this donut of hair and I was just peering out into the world from inside. And you know, for years my mother always said, get your hair cut. And when I did, she still complained. But I had a motorbike too. A big motorbike. A nice one, expensive. And when I decided to become a monk, I realized, no, you can't take your motorbike to be a monk. You know, once I've ridden a motorbike as a monk in Thailand, because they were taking me somewhere, there's no other transport. And the roads were out, you can only get across like a bridge of a plank. So I had to go on the motorbike. And I'll tell you why it's not wise to go on a motorbike as a monk. Because these robes, they balloon out. And you almost get sort of lifted off the motorbike at speed. So it's really dangerous, so I never want to do that ever again. But anyway, I wasn't a monk, I had a nice motorbike. And of course you can't take it to Thailand, you can't sort of use it, so I had to sell it. So I managed to find a friend of my mother's who was interested in getting a motorbike. So he came around, had a look, liked it, and said, how much? You know what happens when you say, how much? I said, let's go up and see my mother first of all. Because I knew I had to do this in front of her, otherwise I'd get in trouble. So in front of my mother, and he said again, now how much do you want for your bike? And I said, do you like it? He said, yeah, I did. How much? I said, if you like it, you can have it for free. And I remember the look on his face. I'll never forget that look on his face. And I was surprised, and then he looked at my mother. He never needed to say anything. I know what he was thinking. My mother knew what he was thinking. Is that guy all right? Is he crazy? Is he a full pack of cards? And my mother said, yeah, he's not crazy. He's becoming a monk. He doesn't need any money. And that's, of course, why you give it, because what's the point of money? When being a monk, you don't need any money. So just, if you want it, take it. And that was such a wonderful moment for me, and also for him as well. He came from a very hard family. And my mother told me afterwards that he'd never forgotten that experience. That was the first time someone had actually given him something expensive, given him something for free. I taught him what generosity really is. Just give, with nothing coming back in return. And those are things, they're acts of kindness and generosity, which you're just giving for the love of it, for the fun of it. And that really gives the meaning in life. We all know just is enough to go around, but just we don't share. And if we could share more, give more, life would be just so beautiful. It would have so much meaning. If you want it, have it. Again, I remember once our lovely committee, I was very proud of them on this occasion, but I wanted to test them out first of all. This was when we were raising funds for our nuns' monastery, or we were building some of the huts there. And someone had given, I think, a donation. I forget how much it was. I think about $2,000. And our committee received a letter from Thailand. They'd run out of money. They were stuck in Bangkok. And they wanted their $2,000 back. And I always remember that. So, you know, what should you do? You know, even for those of you who've read our constitution, who know the law, once you give these things, actually the committee aren't really allowed to give it back. But who cares about laws? Isn't compassion and kindness more important? So I remember the conversation. I was not going to say anything. I was just listening because I want to find out this committee of ours, all the years we've been teaching, whether they really understood what's being taught. You know, is this a society first, or is it a Buddhist first of all? And remember, it's a Buddhist society of Western Australia. Buddhist comes first. It's not society and then Buddhist. And so they talked about this, and the treasurer said, we're not really allowed to, but the poor guy's destitute. What should we do? Let's take a vote. Unanimous, give him the money back. And I was so proud of that committee. Because what's really important? Raising funds for things? Or raising kindness and compassion for things? Isn't it really more important, you know, that we're actually really developing a meaning in life rather than being some sort of other society which just tries to get more and more money out of you and more big buildings and just more wealth and to see our church is bigger than your church sort of stuff? That's not really meaning of life. So it's that kindness and sharing which you find is the meaning of life. And as a monk, as mother monks, the nuns, as the bhikkhunis, they really try and give that meaning to life. You know, of giving, being generous. I said in Singapore that I was visiting another of the temples in Singapore when I first went to visit that city about 9 or 10 years ago. And they took me around the different Buddhist temples, and this one was a Sri Lankan temple over somewhere in Singapore. And the head monk there, he gave me the visitor's book. He said, sign the visitor's book. So I went over, and unfortunately I picked up the wrong book. It wasn't a visitor's book, it was a donation book. My problem was I'd already printed my name and signed it before I actually looked at the next column, which was, how much are you going to give? And that was a big problem as a monk, because I don't have any money. So there you already started, and you can't sort of scrub it out now. So I had to think very quickly. You know, there I put my name, Ajahn Brahm, from Buddhist Society in West Australia in Perth, and the amount of your donation. So I wrote the words, M-Y-L-I-F-E. I give you my life. And I was so happy about it. I thought, wow, now that's meaning. Now you give your life to you guys, and I'll die for you, and I probably will die for you. There's no way I can retire as a monk. So I'm going to die in these robes for sure. Now that is actually gives me enormous amount of meaning in life. And people say, what's in it for you? And sometimes I think that, nothing. Nothing in it for me, except just beautiful peace and happiness and joy and meaning. So my life has enormous meaning. And that's why you get happy and peaceful and get lots of energy. Now, has your life got meaning? How much of you have you given this week? I'm not talking about money. Time. No, forgiveness. This beautiful thing of forgiving. It's a part of a generosity. Giving yourself, even though you get nothing back in return. You forgive this person, you forgive them again, you forgive them again, and still they exploit and exploit and exploit and exploit you. Yeah, if you want to be safe, and if you want to have no trouble, if you want to have sort of a nice house, rich, wealthy, with no problems at all, yeah, just be aggressive. But if you want to have meaning in life, forgive. And you find when you forgive what's really hard to forgive, that gives you enormous meaning. Again, I know that Dennis, he taught me this word a few weeks ago called skiting. And skiting is where you sort of talk about yourself and use yourself as an example. But that's all I can do. That's my example, my life. And last Sunday we're finishing off our meditation retreats, you know, the November retreats down at Jhana Grove. And those of you who've attended, you know, the 9-day retreats which I run, you know, at the very end of the retreat, we do a loving-kindness meditation. And I lead that. And part of that loving-kindness meditation, I do it as well. I'm talking what I'm doing at the time. And part of that loving-kindness meditation, I ask people, can you please imagine a person and just give them so much loving kindness. A good friend, a special person, someone really close to you. And just zap them with metta. May you be totally free from pain and suffering, and may you be always happy and well. And when I did that, the image which came up into my mind was one of the people in Thailand causing me the most trouble about these bhikkhunis. And I was just so surprised and pleased with that. And it came up, and I just zapped them with love. Even though they're causing you so much irritation and so many problems, you think, no, I have no ill will whatsoever. May you be happy and well, and free from pain and suffering. And I thought, wow, that is called a life with meaning. People who have caused you a lot of problems and difficulties, unfairly, maybe untruthfully, who have cheated you, who have robbed you, to give them 100% loving kindness. If you can do things like that, you understand what forgiveness is and how beautiful and how it does give a great meaning in life and how it's irresistible. When that really happens, okay, you ask, well, surely they'll take more advantage of you. I say, fine. Because I don't forgive people. You don't love them to try and get something back. In other words, I'll love my enemy so I can change him not to be an enemy anymore. No, I love you so you can continue to be my enemy. It's a totally different meaning in life. This is spiritual stuff. This is not sort of logical and reasonable stuff. This is the sort of stuff I learned from Down syndrome kids who didn't know how to think like you've been trained to think. They saw things in a totally different way. And that was beautiful and wonderful. And gave that incredible meaning. Because you've each one of you seen those acts of forgiveness and kindness which have brought you to tears. And things which have happened which you think, what on earth is that person doing that for? And how can they do that? But they do that. They forgive the unforgivable. They tolerate the intolerant. Stories of Buddhist monks in China who've been tortured and would never, ever even feel one moment of ill will towards the people torturing them just because they were monks. And that has been done. That can be done. And that gives us a great sense of inspiration and hope and meaning for our lives. It shows that this is our training, this is how we learn, this is what we're here for, to learn not just how to be kinder, not how to be more forgiving, not how to be more generous, not how to be more loving, but why we should. And when we realize why, because it gives us this spiritual wealth, the most important part of ourselves. It gives us meaning in life. Why we're here, why we're growing, why we're doing this. Because sometimes that happens in life, isn't it? Sometimes we get the difficulties and problems in life. We get the sort of the suicides, the sudden deaths, the car accidents. We get the losing of our wealth. We get the person we invest all our love in, our partner in life, cheating on us, having mistresses. We think, why? Why me? In each one of those difficult situations which each one of you bear, which I have to bear, which all of us have to bear from time to time, the so-called unjust, unwarranted, why did this ever happen to me situations. Those are the places where you can find the greatest of meanings. I remember this very, very old story. I was told this about 25 years ago when I first came here to Perth. There was a man who had lost his leg. And he told me that he'd lost his leg in a mine accident up north many years ago. He said his job was actually to put the explosive in the drilled holes on the face of this mine. I don't know if it was iron or whatever mineral they were trying to get out of this mine. He would go there always at night time, because he liked the peace and quiet of working by himself, you know, in the stillness of the deep mind shaft at night time. And he'd only do it at night time because it was dangerous work, and if there was any accidents, he'd be the only one who'd been killed, because all the other people were just sleeping. So that's actually how it worked in those days. So every evening, the driller would drill the holes ready for him, and he'd just go in at night time, put in the explosive and detonate it and make enough cracks in the rock so they can come in the next day and get the ore out. But he said it was just one evening, one night amongst many, he was down there putting in the explosives when he heard a rumble behind him. There's one of the carts, you know, these big metal iron trucks which they'd used to carry the ore from their face back to the surface, you know, on like railway lines. One of the previous workers hadn't put the brakes on, and it was rolling towards him. And the mine shaft was so narrow, there was no place to go. He couldn't go to the left or right. There was no space. And that truck was coming faster and faster. He had no place to go. It was going to hit him. And he said just before it hit, the only thing he thought of doing was actually jumping. The jumping saved one of his legs, but the other one was severed. And he lay there on the tracks at the bottom of the mine, waiting for the morning shift to come and find him, bleeding, in pain. But he actually did survive. And when he was in the hospital, the man who had left the brake off came to the front of the ward, took one look at him and ran away, and he never saw the guy again. The guy felt so guilty for being the cause of this guy losing his legs. But apparently as soon as he saw that guy, the guy lost his legs, shouted at him, "Come in, it's okay." Because that moment, those hours, in pain, having lost his leg, he said that was one of the most beautiful and wonderful experiences of his life. It was the time when he found meaning in life. Meaning of forgiving the person who had left off the brake. Meaning that you don't need just a full body to have a full life. Meaning that physical pain is one thing, but if you get angry and upset, that is 100%, 100 times more pain. He said in those hours waiting, he said he had the most wonderful experiences of his life. He found the meaning in the middle of that accident. I think you can maybe understand what he was talking about. As many people find their meaning in the journey they have from the first diagnosis of a cancer to its eventual remission. The meaning you find in your life when they lose all of your money and you have to reassess your life. Start again. The meaning which you have when you lose your job, when things go wrong in life. These are times, opportunities where you can find the meaning. Because otherwise we just go into life when things go really well for us and it's just ordinary and just as expected. You get lazy. Spiritually lazy, because things are just too easy for you. That's why in Buddhism they say for people wanting to get enlightened, being reborn in the heaven realm, it's just too much fun. You get fat and lazy in heaven. But in this human realm there's enough disappointments, enough tragedies, enough pain, but not too much to wake you up and to be the fertilizer of the spiritual wealth which really give you meaning. Look at those people which you've known who've had tragedies. Look at those people who have lost everything and have risen from those ashes like a phoenix and become the most wonderful, amazing people. Like, say, a Dalai Lama, he lost his country, but he gained a world. Like a Mandela, lost his, 26 years of his youth, but gained this amazing understanding of human nature and ability to forgive and love. These are great examples of people who have used the adversities in life to find their meaning, as Mandela did in those cells of Robben Island. You don't have to go to a prison to find that meaning. Each one of us has our disappointments and tragedies in life. And after we come out of it, we understand what really is important in life. And you know what's important in life. The things which make you happiness, the things which give you meaning, the things which are really solid achievements in your life, are not the medals, not the bank account or the wealth. The things which you really admire and value are things like generosity, compassion and wisdom. Not just the words, because everybody can sort of say words. Everyone can say, yeah, well, I'm compassionate and kind. But it's when it gets really hard to do. I remember again, I just reminiscing about my time as a student. Because again, 5 weeks ago, I was in Cambridge. I went there because the time before I'd been in London, this lady came up to me and she said, I'm the president of the Buddhist Society of Cambridge University. I know you were part of our group 40 years ago and you've neglected us. You haven't come to give a talk. Good point. So I promise the next time I was in that country, I would give a talk at the University Buddhist Society where I grew up as a Buddhist. And I gave a talk there, and so it's wonderful, just the nostalgia of remembering just all of these amazing times. I remember one of the bits of nostalgia was, again, when I became a Buddhist just through reading books. You know, it's called market research. Find out what particular religion you like. Read about it, first of all. Compare and make your choice. So I made the choice of Buddhism, but I had no friends at all, no one I knew who was a Buddhist. So I was so pleased that when I went up to this university, there was this little day called the Society's Fair, with all the different clubs and societies and groups in that university, from astronomical societies, of psychic research society, even hare and hounds. People who like to go hunting, you can join that club if you wanted to. And there was a Buddhist society there. I just couldn't believe it. There was actually another Buddhist in that university, and actually quite a few of them. And I remember just going up to that counter and say, how much does it cost to join? And the other student sitting behind that counter said, no, you don't have to pay any money. You know, you can just come and see. Now maybe later on, if you like it, you can actually pay some money. And I said, no, I want to join now. He said, look, you don't have to, you know, just like here, you don't have to be a member of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia to come and listen to the talks, and it's for free. And I said, no, I want to join, I'm a Buddhist, take my money. I was really aggressive to him. And that was the first time I met one of my close friends, Bernard Carr. He's professor of physics in London University. And so just when I was in England and managed to give him a call, he was in Toronto at some sort of lecture or whatever. And so he's one of my friends. And that's where we first met, when he refused to take my £1 and I forced it on him. And I remember just at that university club once, there was a Tibetan nun. I know it was an English lady, but she was in Tibetan robes. And she gave a talk. It was nothing to do with, I didn't think it was anything to do about Buddhism when I heard it. All it was, you know, no Four Noble Truths, no karma, no nothing. It was just that she was running an orphanage in the town of Kalimpong. I think that was in Sikkim. No, not in Sikkim, but no, next to it. Was it in Sikkim? Yeah, anyway, up there in the northeast of India. And I was so inspired by what she was doing. The following day, I went to my bank and took out £10. And that was 2 weeks' food money for me. I already mentioned my family were very poor. My father had already died. And that meant for the next couple of weeks, I didn't sort of starve, but I went hungry. I couldn't eat as much as I normally would like to eat. because I couldn't afford it. I'd given £10 away. And that was the best £10 I'd ever spent in my whole life. It hurt physically, but I loved that. And I realized little things like that, it showed me what the meaning of life really is. I wasn't thinking about myself, just those kids needed some money. And I could do without food for a couple of weeks, but those kids, if they didn't get that, they'd probably die. When I thought of that, I thought, wow, this is how to give your life meaning. So if any of you, if you see any advertisement on TV in the papers to support a kid in Africa or Cambodia or whatever, don't care what religion they are, do it. Ring up and give. You will never, ever regret that. Because you're putting meaning into your life. Huge meaning. If anyone asks for forgiveness, it might be your partner, the person you're married to, who comes in and said, I've had an affair. You've got a choice. You can follow what maybe your friends or your lawyer says. Divorce them. Screw them for all they're worth. Get as much money out of them. Don't go that path. Forgive. Just say, do you really want this relationship to carry on? Do you? If they say yes, forgive them. It doesn't matter if it doesn't work out. For you, you've made a huge investment in your spiritual wealth. You've given meaning to your life. The meaning that you can be strong enough, trusting enough, to give another person hope. What a wonderful gift that is. Give other people hope. So if you can do that, your meaning of your life improves. And if the relationship goes pear-shaped, it doesn't matter. You think what you've done, you've done the right thing. You've done a beautiful thing, even though it hurts you. You've done something which not many people can do or want to do, but which all religions are supposed to do. What a wonderful thing that is. It means that, yeah, it may hurt you, but in the end of your life, when you look back, you think, wow, I actually did that. And you know that you've grown and matured as a human being. All these things in this life, there are tests. And don't just think just for the, you know, what's going to happen today. See a bigger picture. Yeah, it might hurt today, like having a tooth out. It does hurt, but it's better in the long term. So when you really have this high-mindedness, you're understanding the high meanings of life. And when you do things like that, you will get so much energy inside your heart, so much goodness. The idea of lack of self-esteem just won't be there anymore. You look at yourself and, wow, I am a good person. And when you go to sleep at night like that, you always sleep well. Why is there insomnia? It's because people don't like themselves. Why is there depression and guilt? Because people, they look at themselves and see no value in them. And again, why do people commit suicide, jump off bridges, hang themselves? Because they don't see the value. I'm not talking about, yeah, they may be doing well at school, they may be sort of having a nice partner, but there's something more than that. So when you have the idea of the meaning of life, and you know you put that meaning into your life, if ever you come in here and you get inspired, why do you get inspired? What inspires you? Now, take that back and put that as the ingredient in your life. Just be kind. If it's just a case of just opening a door for someone. I'm going to remember just one lady I got off a bus once when I was a student teacher. I got off the bus and this one poor lady was having a hard time carrying her shopping. And I just said, I can carry that for you, ma'am. just once, a simple thing. And afterwards, she'd always smile at me and give me gifts. Just a simple thing, it got you so much back in return. It got you a friend. And so simple acts of kindness and generosity and help, you get so much back in return. It's unbelievable. So these are the ways you find meaning in your life. There's so many opportunities to do service, so many opportunities to be kind, so many opportunities to be generous, so many opportunities just to let go of what's in it for you and just do it because it needs to be done for others. We all say, why can't we create a better world? And you can't wait for a government to create a better world. You create the better world. You put meaning into your life and you will die such a happy, peaceful person. Realizing, as I said at the very beginning, the two reasons, the two criteria for living a life, for one's own happiness and to be of benefit to other beings. You can tick both boxes. You have helped others. You've got so much happiness inside of yourself. That's what life is all about. That's its meaning. And it's up to you to put that meaning into your life. Thank you for listening. Okay. So, has anyone got any questions or anything? Remember that question, see if you can really offend me tonight. And if anyone says the girls turn you on, look, I'm too old now.